Hey, today is Wednesday, May 20th, second day of the month of Sivan, Yom HaMiyuchas. This is the Chumashir, and we are in the middle of Parshat Noach, Bereshit Perek Tet.
Okay, Rabotai. We are up to Bereshit Perek Tet. Pasuk Yud Bet. Pasuk Yud Bet. Peretet Pasuk Yud Bet. The unit started with HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to Noach and his children. The Ramban pointed out that he never speaks to his children. He speaks to Noach only. And he establishes a covenant with him. Rashi claims that the reason why a covenant was necessary at this time is because he reads Noach's mind. Noach is somewhat concerned, a little hesitant to rebuild. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to assure him that his efforts will not go for naught, and that comes about through the creation of a covenant, which, as we've mentioned many times, a covenant is binding on each of the two members of the covenant, despite the fact that the other one has breached their obligations. That's the difference between a havtacha and a brit. A havtacha is a promise. I promise I will do A if you do B. Well, if you don't do B, I don't have to do A. But in a covenant situation, in a brit, we make a brit that I do A, you do B. But even though you don't do B, I have to observe A. That's the brit that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has established with Noach. That is always the connotation of a brit. And he's going to make it with, as he says in Pasuk Yud Aleph, I will establish this covenant and make a promise to you that lo yikareis kol basar od mimei hamabul. A person will never be eliminated, or at least not humanity, will not be destroyed again as a result of a flood. And there will no longer be a flood that will ultimately destroy the land itself. Now he's going to tell us what the brit is. And today, for the vast majority of our learning today, we will be focused on the words of the Holy Ramban, who elaborates on this particular covenant and offers a glimpse into other covenants as well. So the Torah states, Vayomer Elohim, Zot Ot HaBrit. This is going to be the sign of the brit, Asher Ani Notein. Beini ubeinechem, between you and me. Ubein kol nefesh chaya asher etchem, and between me and all of the animals that are with you. Lidorot, for all future generations, lidorot olam. What is going to be that sign? Et kashti natati be'ana. My bow I have put into the cloud. Put my bow into the cloud. We call it a rainbow, but it doesn't necessarily a rainbow. V'hayta l'ot brit, and it shall be an ot brit beini ubein haaretz, between me and the entire land. So first, let's take a look at Rashi, as we always do. So Rashi deals with not exactly the most troubling issues, but Rashi is somewhat concerned that in Pasuk Yud Bet. The word lidorot is written chaser. There's a vav missing. Dorot is usually, dor is dalet vav resh. So dorot should at least have one vav, perhaps even two vavs. So Rashi says, nichtav chaser. It is written missing the vav. Sheyesh dorot shelo hutzrichu la'ot. There were certain generations that did not need this oath, this promise from God that He will not destroy the land. Why will they not need it? Because they were all righteous people. So if they were all righteous people, there would be nothing to tempt HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to provoke Him to destroy the land. So Lidorot is written chaser to indicate not every single generation, Dorot is generations, not every single generation needs this particular covenant. There will be at least two that Rashi knew of that would not require the covenant. Which were those particular generations? Kimo Dorosha Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda, V'Dorosha Rab Shimon Bar Yochai. The generation of Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda, which the Gemara in Psachim says was an incredibly enlightened and enormously devoted and dedicated generation. And the expression was, Midan ad Be'er Sheva. From Dan all the way in the north until Be'er Sheva in the south, Lohaya Katan, there was no minor that did not know Hilchot Tumot V'Taharot, backwards and forwards. Now, Tumot and Taharot, very difficult, complex halachot, and there was not one minor, let alone an adult, who did not know and observe the laws of Tahara during that particular generation, and as a result, they would not have needed the benefit of the covenant. They would never have been destroyed in any event. The Gemara says that the Chizkiyahu, according to many, they believed was the Messiah. And for some reason, he was not the Messiah. It was not realized, but potentially he certainly had the ability to do so. And the second generation was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, as you well know, is one of the students of Rabbi Akiva, who survived that terrible plague described in Masechet Yevamot, for which 24,000 students die. And he and four others revive all of Torah, and he becomes the next Rashi Kibahag. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was a generation of incredible piety and enormous self-sacrifice. And there's an interesting story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which the Gemara in Brachot quotes, saying that when he was dying, he was crying like a baby. And his students asked him, "Why are you crying? Look at the merits that you have for having rebuilt all of Torah." And he says the following. He says, "I have no idea where they're going to be taking me. There are two paths, a fork in the road. I have no idea which road I'm going to... One is for Gan Eden, the other one is Gehinom. And I don't know where I'm going." And the Rav once has said that, don't think this is false modesty. Because when you are Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, to say that you missed Agunisht is not modesty. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai didn't go around saying, I'm a nothing. Ich bin der Agunisht. The next guy says, Ich bin der aggressor Agunisht. I'm a bigger nothing. You know, that's not what Anivut means. So he said that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai had to make one of the most crucial decisions around, and he was never sure if he made the right decision or not. What crucial decision? During the siege of Yerushalayim, so Vespasian granted Rav Shimon Bar Yochai one request, and his one request was, "I want to meet Vespasian." Okay. But he had to be smuggled out of the city. Everybody knows the story. Finally, Vespasian, he gets to meet Vespasian. Vespasian says, "What's your one wish?" So he could have said, "I want the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt." He didn't say that. What did he say? "Tein li Yavne v'chachameha." Give me the Torah scholars. I'm going to Yavne, and we will set up shop for the Sanhedrin in Yavne. So the Rav said, this question tormented Rav Shimon Bar Yochai for the rest of his life. Did I make the right decision? On the one hand, if not for the scholars of the Sanhedrin, it would be difficult to teach Torah and have, you know, an educated community. On the other hand, to the laymen, they're not particularly interested in Talmud Torah. What attraction does the layperson have to ritual service? And this is a debate that was carried out very much later and became, you know, lionized in the debate between the Brisker Rav and what's his name? Hey, you know, who started Chassidus? Who? The Baal Shem Tov. What was the bris? What is the Gaon's whole claim? That if you don't engage in serious learning, you're not connected to Am Yisrael. You're not. And the Baal Shem Tov said, if you pray and you do nice masim tovim, you can be just as good a member of Klal Yisrael. And there were heated debates. And in effect, Rab Shimon Bar Yochai himself, not against someone else, was tormented with that particular question. Do I advocate for the Beit HaMikdash? So Vespasian will grant me my request and will build a Beit HaMikdash. And everybody can come three times a year at least, or what, every day if you want, offer a korban, go home and do whatever you please. But at least you feel connected to the people through ritual service, as a lot of people do. Not everybody has the ability to learn. Or do I say, I'm going to promote the Sanhedrin, the scholars, and that's going to be the future of Am Yisrael. And he never knew if he made the right decision. And as he was dying, he said, "Eini yodea be'eze derech molichin oti." I have no idea as to what is going to be the formula for success for future generations, or maybe I destroyed Am Yisrael by my selection. And that's why he said, maybe I'm going to Gehenna, maybe I'm going to Gan Eden, not because he wasn't personally observant, there was nothing wrong with Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, but he felt that he made a crucial decision about the future direction of Am Yisrael, and he wasn't 100% sure that it was the right decision. But it turned out to be, it was the right decision, because his particular generation was incredibly pious, incredibly dedicated, and scholars blossomed under his direction. Even though, I might add, his recommendation for success was not approved by the Gemara. He believed you should be learning 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and don't go to work. Who will take care of your milachtecha na'aseit al yidei acherim? Somebody else will plow your field and you'll have enough money to make. That's what he believed. So the Gemara, and Rabbi Shmuel challenged him. He said, that's ridiculous. Rabbi Shmuel said, you have to learn, of course, but you have to go to work, because nobody's going to be doing any work for you. Nobody. So the Gemara says that harbe, many, tried to follow the school of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, velo alu biyadam. They were not successful. V'harbe asu ki Rabbi Shmuel v'alu biyadam. And many people followed Rabbi Shmuel and were successful. Today, that debate seems to have totally been forgotten as to what direction people should be taking. But his generation was indeed an enormously pious. Not everybody was a scholar, but there was enormous intensity of religious devotion. And as a result, his particular generation, says Rashi, would not have needed the Brit, because there would be no fault to find with this generation, and it would have been spared on its own merit. So you have two generations. That's pretty pathetic that in Rashi's time, only 800 years, 900 years ago, you could only find two generations that fit that category. Only two. You know, if I'm missing a vav, I could have said there are six generations. Missing two vavs, 12 generations. But Rashi couldn't find any. Yeah.
Israel.
Correct. Correct. So he met the world, but right. But Noah was. It's a good question. That generation does not mean. Okay, that's true. But many have pointed out that God reserves the right to eliminate certain communities, as He has, by flood. The only promise that has been made is that He will not destroy the entire world by flood at one time. But individual communities, no problem. So even if he had decided to destroy the rest of the world, this particular community would have been saved independently, without the promise. Good. Let's continue now. Took one more Rashi. Turn the page. Rashi comments on V'haya ba'anani ananan al ha'aretz v'nirata hakeshet be'anan. Take a look at Rashi. Be'anani anan. Kishita'ale b'machshava lifonai Lahavi Choshech ve'ibadon le'olam. When will this sign serve as a sign? When I start thinking what? That I want to destroy. Then I will see this sign, and what will happen? I'll change my mind. I'll change my mind. So, how does Rashi get that from this phrase, ba'anani anan? What does that mean? So, what's bothering Rashi is, first of all, the double expression. What does it mean, ba'anani anan? And number two, there is not always a rainbow out. You know, every so conveniently that what? That when people are doing bad things, what's going to happen? Well, now I see the anan, I won't destroy people. How do you see that connection between the rainbow and then what? The decision that God made. How do we look at the appearance of a rainbow? Ask any little kid. When you see a rainbow, what happens? What message is it trying to tell you? God wanted to destroy them, and now what happens? He sees it, and he's not going to destroy. So,
maybe it's a reminder to us, we're not being so good, do a little tshuva right now.
That certainly is true. No doubt about that. That certainly is true. But how does that answer the thing, be'anani be'anan?
When I look at the cloud.
So, but what does it mean? Right. Rashi's trouble with the double expression of anan anan. Be'anani, when I'm in the cloud? No. Be'anan?
So that's
a little stretch. But, good. So what Rashi's trying to tell us, that the word be'anani should not necessarily talking about that God is in the cloud. When I am in the cloud, or I see, what?
Answering.
That's interesting. Rashi doesn't quite say answering. He says, kishita'ale b'machshava. It means that...
When you're about to cloud it.
What?
Be'anani, as I am going to be clouded.
But that's right. That's what it really means.
Right.
When I will be clouded, and what will as a result appear? This anan will appear, this keshet will appear, then I will have known, you will have known that what? I was in my cloud thinking to do what?
Destroy.
And then I see that the anan with the keshet, and I chose not to do so. The Ramban's going to elaborate on Rashi to make it a little clearer.
In a cloudy state?
That could very well, that's a good way to look at it. In a cloudy state, good. We'll see now Ramban, he will elaborate on Rashi's comment. But first let's take a look at the beginning of the Ramban, where it says page 1. I bracketed the Ramban. So first Ramban will debate an issue, which is not terrible. He goes up, winds up saying, it makes no difference what I said. Because the message or not is clear no matter which perspective I take. He asks the following question. Was this anan, whatever you want to call rainbow, in existence at the time of the creation of the world? Was this such a phenomenon? Or is God creating it now to remain in nature, but this is a new creation? So let's see what the Ramban says. Mimashma min ha'ot hazeh, from the fact that I am identifying this sign, it appears shelo haya keshet be'anan b'maaseh bereshit. There was no such thing as a bow in the cloud, what we call a rainbow, at the time of maaseh bereshit. Va'ata bara Hashem chadasha la'asot keshet b'shamayim b'yom anan. God created this phenomenon to create a rainbow in the sky on a cloudy day. On a cloudy day. Biyom anan, on a cloudy day. The Omro, and it said, Bita'am ha'ot hazeh, ki ha'keshet lo asa'o shiyurag lav lamala, shiyireh ki'ilu min ha'shamayim morimbo. think of a bow, an archer's bow. If it is pointing upward, if the bow is pointing upward, where is the string? Right next to God. Right? On top. If the bow is up, the string is on top. So when you have a bow and the string is next to what? The person who can shoot, what imagery is it creating?
Aimed
at people. You would take it in the wrong direction. What is God's intention when you see the rainbow? He's coming to war. Coming to war. Because the sign of going to war was the archer preparing his bow so that he can, pull the string and let the arrow go. God is described, as we read in the Shira every morning, as Ish Milchama. That's one of his characteristics. So the way he would indicate to the world, I am coming, I am going to be attacking, is by having the bow pointed upward with the string right next to him, shooting down upon the civilians of this earth. That's not the way the rainbow looks.
That's correct.
The Ramban says it's not up. Which way is it? Down. So the bow is facing the shooter. The bow, not the string. The bow itself is facing the shooter.
Hashem shoot.
What does this mean? The sign of all soldiers at that time, when they wanted to demonstrate as what? We're looking to establish peace. How do you demonstrate your civilian peace? You turn your bow around. And the bow was next to the arc, the bow side, so you can't shoot an arrow if the string is not facing you, if the bow is facing you. So the universal symbolic way of of looking to strike peace is through the bow. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is looking through the painting to establish peace. I'm angry with you, but I'm not here to eliminate you. I'm here to tell you, you're going to survive. And in fact, this imagery of the bowmaster is something that the Ramban employs in other occasions as well. There is a mitzvah in Sefer Dvarim in two locations. In Va'et Hanan, as well as in Parshat Shoftim, and three times Parshat Ki Tetzeh, that we are to go conquer certain nations. Right? The seven nations that we're about to enter, Amalek and so on and so forth. So there's a fundamental debate between the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam writes that when God tells you to kill Chiti, Amori, and Prizi, and so on and so forth, there is no invitation to peace. Just go and destroy them without asking any questions. And the Ramban says, Ze lo yitachen. Ki le'olam. In every situation, what should you do, even if it's the worst enemy of your people? What should you do? Extend an offer of shalom. If they don't accept the offer of shalom, then you attack. And there are definitions, there are obligations that come along with accepting shalom. Doesn't mean just we let you off the hook. You pay taxes to Medinat Yisrael, and you have to observe Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. That's what the Chiti and the Mori were offered. If you turn it down, we're going to mow you down. But it's impossible that, says the Ramban, that when you're out to go to war, the first thing you should do is turn the bow around. Show the people, whoever you're about to conquer, we don't really want to kill you. We'd like to extend peace. Okay, there are terms that peace, for every peace treaty has terms. You're going to have to agree to our terms. If you don't, you're going to have to go to war. But the imagery that he uses is the soldier going out on the field, turning around the bow, and not being able to shoot the arrow. Here too, says the Amru, "Bitamot ki hakeshet lo asa'o, shiyu raglav lamala." This is line 4. "Shiyir akilu min ha-shamayim borim bo. Vayishlach hitzav, vayifitzein ba'aretz." And he sent his arrows and scattered them throughout the world. No. "Aval asa'o behepech mizeh." He made the bow just the opposite, facing down. Laharot shelo yoru bo min hashamayim. There will be no arrows being shot down from heaven. V'chein derech hanilchamim. This is the way of the warrior. La'hafoch oto biyadam kacha ka'asher yikru l'shalom l'mishe kenegdam. As you extend the hand of peace to anybody who you are attacking. Now, that's what his first opinion is. Then, skipping a line for a second, Va'anachnu al korchenu na'amin l'divrei ha'yivanim. We are going to really accept the opinion of the Greeks. They say, how was the rainbow created? The right light reflecting off what? Off the water. Good. Shemilahat Hashemesh, through the rays of the sun, be'avir, in the environment, halach, in the moist environment, yakesh es betolada, it will give birth to what? To a rainbow. Ki bekli mayim, because even in a utensil full of water, bekli mayim, next page, that's the end of the Yeah, I'll see you in a second. Ki bekli mayim, oh, this is, must have skipped something. What's the next word that you have? Shemesh.
I got it.
Hashem is yireh kimarei hakeshet. Then what will it appear? As a rainbow. V'kasher nistakel od b'lashon ha-katuv navinken. If you look a little further in the pasuk, you'll see that God didn't create this now. This is just a phenomenon in nature that was in existence. Ki amar et kashti notati be'anan. V'lo amar ani notain be'anan. What does it say? I put my bow in the cloud. It doesn't say I am putting it there, because it was in existence already and it's part of the laws of nature. Umilat kashti moreh shahaitala hakeshet chila. And the word kashti indicates that what? My bow. I've had this bow for a while. Now I'm going to use it as a sign. V'lachein nifareish ha-katuv. Therefore we will explain the pasuk. Hakesha sheshenatati be'anan miyom habriya. The bow that I placed in the cloud from the very day of creation. Tihiyem min ayom hazeh v'hala la'ud berit b'ni u'b'neichem. But the Ramban is saying that a covenant doesn't have to be something created just now. You can take anything already in existence and simply... What? Of course, he's going to quote several illustrations. And simply say that this physical item that has been here for 4,000 years now will serve as what? As the symbol of the covenant between me and you. Shekol... Yeah. Shekol Zman, in line 6, She'erena, every time I see it, as kirbi ki berit shalom b'ni b'neichem, I will remember that this is the covenant between you and me. V'im tevakesh ma ta'am bakashat liyot od, bekeshet liyot eid. If you'll ask, why specifically a bow to be the sign? He answers, Hine hu kitam eid hagal hazeh ve'eidah hamatzeva. You'll see where he's leading to. When Yaakov and Esav are... Yaakov and Lavan are getting together after Yaakov runs away from Lavan's house. Lavan runs after them. And they said, L'cha v'nichrusa brit ani va'ata. Let's make a covenant. So they take a mound and they build this little mound. They say, Eid Hagal Hazeh. This mountain is what? Is testimony. So he quotes that. Or, et sheva kivsot hatzon tikach miyadi bavur tiyel eidasha. That's Avraham and Avimelech. Avraham and Avimelech didn't get along for a while. Then one of Avimelech's servants, or Avimelech himself, took Sarah. Didn't turn out too well for him. Avimelech, after he released Sarah, what did he decide to do? I have to make a covenant. So what did they take? Et sheva kivsot hatzon. Seven shepselots, and little sheep. So what the drift is the Ramban is? What's the drift?
Anything can be a
sign. You mean to tell me a pile of rocks, if something has anything unique and holy in it? Doesn't have anything holy in it? They decided that's going to be the seven little sheep came down from heaven somehow to establish this covenant. No. You pick on something and you now make this as a sign of the covenant. Yes, of course, the Ramban in each case will look for some type of symbolic meaning. Why was this item chosen to what? To serve as the bread. So it's a little easier when you're talking about Yaakov and Lavan. When you build a wall, Yaakov's idea is to what? Create a barrier between the two people. I don't want there to be any integration. So the way to demonstrate that is to build a wall. Sometimes it's a little more difficult to figure out what the covenant will be. So here he's going to be struggling a little initially. Why does it have to be a bow indicating this particular... I know he said it already, it's a symbol of a warrior. And perhaps our chata'im will trigger God's emotion to act like a warrior. Okay, we'll see. He might offer something else as well. Yeah. Okay. So now go to page number 3 for a minute. And we'll continue for a second. Line 2. Ubein shetihiyeh, the middle of line 2. Ubein shetihiyeh hakeshes ata. Whether this bowl was created now, bein shahayah me'olam bateva, or whether it was already created in the world of nature, hatam be'ot sheba echadu. The reason for this bowl makes no difference when it was created. The symbolism of the bowl is going to be operative whether it was created or it's been in time for creation. Avol yesh l'rabosenu parsha hazot sod ne'elam. But this parsha contains hidden secrets. Sod ne'elam. Now usually when the Ramban quotes hidden secrets, he writes, that's all. V'havein yavin. Figure it out. I'm not going to release it to you.
I can't figure it out
either sometimes. You're not the only one. A lot of people struggle to see what he has in mind. But here, whenever he says, I'm going to tell you sod ne'elam, what's he relying on? Kabbalah. Kabbalistic literature. This is one of the things that differentiated the Ramban from many other early scholars, medieval scholars. The Ramban was an expert in Kabbalah. And in addition to knowing Chumash, obviously the text, and knowing Pshat and the Midrash, he also offered Kabbalistic interpretations of the Torah text. That's why the Ramban's breadth of every area of Torah was probably like none other in Jewish history. I'm not talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. But the Rambam, for example, never ever indicated that he knew anything about Kabbalah. Never. If he did, he kept it to himself. The Rambam never wrote a perush on Chumash. The Ramban has one of those several intriguing, complex commentaries on Shas, all of Shas. He is, the most complex perush on Chumash, the most profound perush on Chumash, and a great doctor as well, and a Kabbalist. So his breadth was just unbelievable. And in fact, he was so enriching that there was once a panel discussion at Gush, and they asked several Rabbeim, and it's incorporated as dialogue stories that he has with another Rav. and today's the end of the Shloshim Vavaron. Somebody asked me, if you are alone on a desert island and you can take one book, what would you take? So he said the Perush of the Ramban and Chumash. That's what he would take with him. That's how impressed and how profound it spoke to him. For the Ramban's Perushim, that's the only book I would take if I was allowed only one book. Yeah. So he's going to try to tell us, Amru Bebeshus Rabbit said in the Medrash, Es kashti nasati be'anan, kashosi davar shuhu mokesh li. Keshes can mean something else besides a bow, at least according to the Midrash. What does the word mokesh mean?
Obstacle.
An obstacle. Exactly. It's a stumbling block. It's a stumbling block. Shuhu mokeshli.
What is kashoti?
Kashoti is davar shuhu mokeshli. Keshet, hakeshet shali. Kashoti is something which is a stumbling block. A stumbling block. So the Medrash asks, Efsher Kain, is it humanly possible that what? That there is anything that is a stumbling block in the presence of God? How do you speak of a stumbling block in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How is it possible? Ella kashin deparia. Kashin deparia. What does that mean? Kashin deparia means that which is of a fruit, the part that is not the ikar of the fruit, the inner core, like the pit of the fruit. That's what the Medrash answers. So we have no idea what he's talking about. No idea what he's talking about. So he's going to try to continue. Rabbi Yudan b'shem Rabbi Yehuda b'Rab Simon Omer. Rabbi Yehuda, the name of Rabbi Yudan, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rab Simon, said, Mashala echad. Shebiyado solet roteach. Somebody had burning hot flour in his hand. Ubikesh litno albino. And he wanted to put the burning flour on his son. Obviously, his son was a troublemaker. Vinosno alavdo. And he put it instead on his servant. That's Rabbi Yudin's great explanation about the stumbling block. What do you think is... What is imagery is he trying to portray? Is he trying to portray? What imagery is he trying to portray? What?
A kapara, something else getting hurt with your sins. You know, that kind of...
Okay. It means your son is deserving of what? Of the punishment. There's no doubt about that. So instead, you punish one of his servants. Now, is that terribly fair? Obviously not. It's not terribly right. Why would you punish the servant for the transgressions of the son?
So the son will be warned and say, that should have been me.
I understand. But why would he put the burning sick? Why would he do it on his Eved? It's very difficult to explain. But now you have to go back to the original imagery. Why is this an obstacle? What happens? What's the obstacle? God sees us, all of Am Yisrael, engaging in sin. Now he sees the bow, and that's the obstacle. What's that? What's the obstacle?
That he can't
destroy us.
That
he can't what? Can't destroy us. So what does he have to do? He has to pour out his wrath somewhere, someplace. So, on what? We don't know. We don't know. He's got to pour his wrath out someplace else. He doesn't tell us what the nimshal is. He uses the mashal of the son and the eved, and it leaves it up to our vivid imagination. We all know what the son, that's us. But who's that eved who he's now going to pour out his wrath on? Instead of, now why is that a stumbling block? Why is that a stumbling block? And that's why he said it's sod ne'elam. Because God knows that by pouring it out on someone else, what's he doing?
They're going to take revenge on
him. No, no. He's doing something essentially wrong. He's doing something essentially wrong. Yes. And hence, when he sees this stumbling, when he sees this keshes, he knows it's going to lead him to what? To do something which is fundamentally unsound. No, it doesn't say it's going to stop him. It's going to stop him from what?
Destroying
the people. But somebody is going to suffer in its place. The fact that people sin, something has to happen if people sin. So God's wrath will either be let out directly at the person responsible, or God's wrath will be let out somewhere else.
Maybe that's like the destruction of the Beit Mikdash instead of all people.
That is an, when there is a Mikdash, that is an excellent suggestion. And in fact, I'll tell you, can you give me another word that can be framed with Mem Shin Kuf Kaf Nun? Another word. Think about it alone. What? A mashkon. What is a mashkon? Security. The security that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us to somehow make sure he doesn't kill us is do what? Build a Beis HaMikdash. Means a lot. So instead of what? Wiping out every person on Yisrael, what I'm going to do? Destroy the Beis HaMikdash. It's a mashkon. It's somehow, it's collateral on behalf of Am Yisrael. And that's why, for example, the last pasuk of chapter 1 of Sefer Yeshayahu, which we read every Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, Tzion b'mishpati padeh v'shaveha b'tzdaka. Tzion will be redeemed through mishpat, and its return is through tzedakah, charity. So here is the case, through the imagery of the loan. If I extend a loan to you, and I demand collateral, and now the payday comes, and you don't have the money, but I say I'm mochel the chov. What does mochel mean? I forgive the debt. Okay, you don't have to pay me back. I'm a nice guy. You don't have to pay me back. What happens to the collateral that I got from you? It has to be returned to you. The only reason why I'm allowed to have the collateral is why? So here too. Here is the pshat of the pasuk, and it relates to it. Tzion, you have to read the pasuk in reverse. Acharei sheshaveha bitztaka. Once God will allow the people of Am Yisrael to return, because he did an act of charity, what is he going to have to do? Give us back the Beit HaMikdash. Because once he forgives us, which is an act of charity, tzedakah, he's got to give back the mashkan. Tzion b'mishpati padeh acharei sheshaveha b'tzedakah. After he decides to forgive us, because he's a good guy, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu has no choice. He must allow us to build the Beit HaMikdash through justice. Because if you forgive the loan, you have to give back the collateral. So what the Ramban is alluding to here, that somehow HaKadosh Baruch Hu feels guilty and upset at himself, that for some reason he's got to release some pent-up energy of his, and he decided it's not going to be the people, so I got to pour out somewhere else. And it's totally not fair, whoever the recipient is going to be, so claims this midrash, in the name of what he calls Sod. However, then, without reading it inside, he comes to the conclusion that it represents totally something else. That the arrow pointing down is simply telling us that initially God was planning to treat this world with Midat HaDin. That's what he's planning. And he has a right to do so. If he expects certain behavior, he is entitled to it. So if he operated with Midas HaDin, what would happen? The consequences would have to be realized. However, as soon as he sees that cloud, the rainbow pointing down, it's telling him that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam has to look at his people on earth and say, they're only human beings. They are not my heavenly bodies that are upstairs. I have to take my gaze away from my heavenly court who always does exactly what I tell him to do. There has not been one malach in history who has not done what he's supposed to do, whatever malachim are. But in the world of angels, they all are loyal and dedicated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So God takes the keshet, where he can feel very comfortable pointing, oh, look at my majesty up here. And have those same expectations of people down here. But then he turns the bar upside down, he says, he looks at them, and he says, these are little midgets compared to the people upstairs. Upstairs, they're the giants. Here, they're little midgets. They're not angels. They make mistakes. They are a stubborn people, and they continue to make mistakes. So the transition of the bow from its upward position to its downward position is telling us God had a chance to focus on us, treating us and holding us to the expectations of the angels. Then he realizes, no, that's not fair, turns the bow upside down and says, these are human beings, frail human beings, with strengths and weaknesses. And as a result, he suddenly melts like butter, and he decides to handle the world not with midat hadin, but rather with midat harachamim. And hence, the emphasis is, if you read pasuk, just one second, in pasuk yudalid, v'haya be'anani anan al haaretz. The Anan is not the Aretz. Where is the Anan? So what do you mean, Vaya Ba'anani Anani Al Aretz? But the Keshet's not in the Aretz either. It's still in the sky. Its direction is pointing down, focusing on man, as opposed to the bow facing up, which is pointing towards heaven bound. Yes. Very true. That is true. Very true. Yeah. So kachahein divrei haramban.
That's such a completely different idea of the keshet.
Let me hear.
It's kind of like a Pollyanna kind of thing. That Hashem was saying to us that I'm no longer going to, with rain, I'm no longer going to destroy the world, but I'm going to bring you something beautiful.
Yes. Geshem Bracha instead of
right.
Geshem Prayer.
Very nice.
That's how I am.
Yes.
Can I just expand on that?
Of course.
Part of that is also, you know, it's, when it's been, it's cloudy, and you don't see the light, and it's only by virtue of light coming through the clouds that you get the window to refract off of the moisture.
Yeah. Very, yeah. That's true. Yeah. Very nice, yes.
I had many years ago, I lived near Rabbi Ganek, and one Shabbos afternoon there was a rainbow. So I walked over the two houses, his house, and Rabbi Ganek was outside. He said, did you see the beautiful rainbow? He said, never talk about it. Never tell anybody to look at it.
It's correct. It's one of the things which there's a Gemara in Sight that says you're not supposed to stare at. It's like the hands of the Birchat Kohanim. You're not supposed to look at the rainbow directly. What? You just know it's there, but you don't gaze at it. You don't gaze. I know, but it's because I don't know exactly. What? Yes. Yes. No doubt.
When she saw a rainbow, went hysterical crying because of what she learned in yeshiva. Is that what this is? I didn't understand what her problem was in seeing a rainbow.
Well, it's, if you used the simple standard, God was going to destroy you, and now so you feel badly, God was ready to destroy you. You know. What? I don't know. Don't know. Yeah.
It only says that it's a sign for Hashem himself.
That's okay. No, but he says Beinu Beinecha. That's what the sign is.
So when I look at it, it will remind me.
Yes.
But not that you should look at it.
Okay, very nice. Very nice. Okay, we'll stop here and continue next Devach.